airplanes in untraditional ways, staffing, logistics. So there's a lot of pieces that have to line up here.
The federal government is open, but a top airline official says it could take up to a week to sort out the skies.
For Thursday, November 13th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. We'll also look at how the pause in federal food benefits scrambled lives and what comes next.
I think maybe everybody hopefully has somebody in their life that is affected by this, and it can kind of make it a little more personal.
And in our latest series on the cost of living, we turn to clothes and hear how as costs go up, more and more people are turning to outfit rentals.
I now get to wear silk items that I otherwise would never bother cleaning. And I don't even know what you do with, I don't know what you do with silk.
Plus, how college athletes are navigating the toxic pits of social media.
That and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. With the federal shutdown over, full SNAP food benefits are finally being restored, but NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports anxiety over the funding pause will linger.
Jacqueline Giamona and her two kids rely on SNAP for nearly all their groceries, and the past 2 weeks without it were tough. She says depriving low-income people of a necessity like food was an abuse of power.
People are going to distrust the government, and I think people are going to be really angry about it for a long time.
Advocate Crystal Fitzsimons with the Food Research and Action Center would like Congress to prevent a repeat.
It does make me nervous that this could be used as a negotiating tactic again.
She and others do see one positive. They say all the attention has shown just how vital SNAP is for so many people. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
A federal judge heard arguments today challenging the appointment of the U.S. attorney who secured the indictments against former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
Attorneys for both James Comey and Letitia James say that interim U.S. attorney Lindsey Halligan was unlawfully appointed. Because of that, they say, the separate indictments against Comey and James should be found invalid and dismissed. The Justice Department, meanwhile, argues that Halligan's appointment is valid and legal, and any perceived problem with it is at most, quote, a paperwork error. U.S. District Judge Cameron McGowan Curry was assigned to hear challenges to Halligan's appointment. Curry heard a little more than an hour of arguments from defense attorneys and prosecutors. She did not rule from the bench, but she did say she plans to issue her ruling by Thanksgiving. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Alexandria, Virginia.
Home insurance is increasingly expensive in many parts of the country, including the central U.S., NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
The average price of property insurance in the Great Plains is significantly higher than the national average, according to a report from the Treasury Department. Consumers in the Southern Plains states paid 45% more than average between 2018 and 2022, the report found. That's in part because of hailstorms. Scott St. George is a climate scientist at WTW, a risk analysis company.
You've seen some big losses coming out of hail, mostly in the U.S.
Hailstorms caused an estimated $160 billion of damage to homes nationwide last year, according to the Insurance Information Institute, an industry-run think tank. Storms that produce large hail are getting more likely due to climate change. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Airlines are optimistic they can resume normal operations soon once the government lifts its order to cut flights after the shutdown. The FAA says airlines won't have to cut more than 6% of flights at the 40 busiest airports because air traffic controller staffing has improved significantly. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. More than 1,000 Starbucks workers are on strike at 65 stores across the U.S. The action has closed some stores on Starbucks' Red Cup Day, which is typically one of the company's busiest days of the year. Starbucks says fewer than 4% of its U.S. stores are unionized, and sales were exceeding its expectations this morning. The Pleiades star cluster turns out to be part of a larger complex of stars that stretches across the night sky. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, astronomers say these stars were all born in the same cloud of dust and gas about 100 million years ago.
The Pleiades is also known as the Seven Sisters, but even if you look with just binoculars, this cluster clearly contains a lot more than seven stars. Luke Bauma is with Carnegie Science in Pasadena, California.
When you look at the core of the Pleiades, it's sort of like looking at the tip of an iceberg, right? You only see the top of something that's much more massive, and in this case, distributed over the night sky.
He and some colleagues used data from three different observatories to trace the motion and chemical compositions of stars, letting them find more than 3,000 related stars that have similar ages and makeups and that used to be closer together. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Doritos and Cheetos are getting a makeover. PepsiCo says it's launching toned-down versions of its bright orange snacks that won't have any artificial colors or flavors. The new chips are set to hit store shelves on December 1st. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure, with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on People Powered Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington, where the federal government has reopened, but that does not mean everything is back to normal. Consider the U.S. air travel system. Temporary flight reductions are still in place at dozens of airports across the country, and aviation regulators have not said when they'll lift. NPR transportation correspondent Joel Rose joins us now with more. Hey, Joel.
Hey, Scott.
What's the latest on these restrictions?
Aviation officials said last night that these temporary flight reductions will stay at 6% instead of ramping up to 10% as they were scheduled to do. The Federal Aviation Administration says these cuts were necessary to keep the airspace safe as the agency grappled with a staffing shortage of air traffic controllers during the government shutdown. Those air traffic controllers, of course, have been working without pay during the shutdown. Some took on second jobs and many called out sick. Over this past weekend, the FAA reported staffing shortages at dozens of facilities at once, leading to some of the worst delays of the entire shutdown. This week, the number of staffing shortages declined sharply to just a handful over the past few days, and that gave regulators some confidence that more controllers are coming to work. But they say they will not lift these reductions completely until the safety data improves.
Given that, how quickly do we think airlines will be able to get back to their regular schedules?
Airlines seem pretty confident that they can ramp up quickly. I mean, once the air traffic control situation is stabilized, maybe within just a few days of getting the word from the FAA. Chris Sununu is the CEO of Airlines for America, the industry trade group. He addressed this question on a call with reporters yesterday. Here's some of what he said.
You got to make sure the airlines are repositioning their assets, right? Because it's not just canceling one flight. Canceling one flight has a domino effect. They've had to move different actual airplanes in untraditional ways, staffing, logistics. So there's a lot of pieces that have to kind of line up here.
Sununu says it might take up about a week for airlines to get back to full pre-shutdown normal, as he put it. But he is optimistic that they can get there before the Thanksgiving holiday rush that begins in earnest next week.
Let's talk about air traffic controllers. This had been a focus during the shutdown. It's obviously a very stressful and important job. Any sense when they will get paid for all the work they did?
Yeah, they missed two full paychecks and part of a third. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said this week they would get paid quickly once the government reopened. Duffy said they would get the bulk of their money, about 70%, within 48 hours and the rest within another week. But some air traffic controllers remember that this is not how it went last time. They say the FAA made a lot of errors after the last government shutdown in 2018 and 2019 and did not pay some of what controllers say they were owed in overtime and shift differentials. Some controllers actually sued the federal government for that compensation that they said was missing. The case eventually settled just this year, so it took over 5 years for some of them to be made whole. And I've spoken to several controllers who say they are wary of something like that happening again.
Now, President Trump floated the idea of a $10,000 bonus for people who worked all of their scheduled shifts during the shutdown. Any word on whether that's a real thing?
Secretary Duffy was asked about that earlier this week, and he said he supports the idea. He called it brilliant. And depending on how many controllers there are who qualify, Duffy said they should come to the White House so that the president could present them with their checks in person. I asked for details on how these bonuses might work from both the FAA and the Department of Transportation. So far, no response from either.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's almost the holidays, and with it comes office parties, family gatherings, and the dreaded question of what to wear to those things. NPR has been explaining the forces driving up prices in our series, Cost of Living, The Price We Pay. And today, we look at clothing. Rising inflation and tariffs are complicating the hunt for this year's hottest ugly sweater. But as NPR's Christian Monroe explains, there's an alternative to buying it.
2 years ago, Lydia Patel made a big decision. The pharmacist, content creator, and mom of three was sick of seeing all the clothes she used to wear to kids' birthday parties and events languishing inside her closet.
I go to work in scrubs. I don't dress up for work anymore. So I really don't need a whole lot of new clothes.
So she decided to stop buying them.
I don't really want to hang on to pieces forever. By the time I have something else to go to, the trends will have changed. My taste might have changed.
But that didn't mean no new clothes. She decided, why not rent instead? Patel joins thousands of women borrowing high-end premium clothes like dresses, jeans, and even winter coats each month for a fraction of the original price. She says renting has opened up a whole new world, a world of luxury fabrics.
I now get to wear silk items that I otherwise would never bother cleaning. And I don't know what you do with silk. I don't want to.
The popularity of rental fashion has been fueled by fears that inflation and tariffs could be back in vogue. While clothing prices are up 9% since the start of COVID, that pales in comparison to the rise of overall inflation over that same period. But what the future holds for the cost of clothing, well, that remains unclear. Nearly all clothing in the United States is made overseas in countries like China and Vietnam, which face up to 20% in additional taxes imposed by the Trump administration this year. As these tariffs settle in, Sky Canavis, principal analyst at eMarketer, says they'll make their way through the supply chain and into shopping bags.
As brands and retailers have to pay more to import clothing, they will have to pass on those costs, at least some of those costs, to consumers.
That could affect rental fashion, which isn't immune to the impact of tariffs. One of the biggest rental platforms is Nuuly, owned by the same company that owns Urban Outfitters, Anthropologie, and Free People. And it's working to tackle the challenge of tariffs.
We're definitely trying to manage through it and doing a lot to manage through it.
That's Nuuly president Dave Hain. He says buying wholesale, working alongside his popular sister brands, is helping. And if customers are happy with their clothes, Nuuly's happy to sell it to them at a discount. The goal, to save the holidays from the tariff grinch. But not so fast, Cindy Lou Who. The holidays are just one of the busiest times of year for renting. And that added demand could mean the odds of getting your hands on that light-up Rudolph sweater might be harder than you thought. Companies like Rent the Runway and Nuuly are trying to avoid running out of items. But Hain admits it's hard to get those numbers right.
One of the most important things for this business to be successful is trying to kind of balance inventory levels with subscriber levels.
Hain says if you are hoping to dress to impress at your office party, rent as soon as you can. So renting is what Lydia Patel is planning to do this busy holiday season.
I don't miss buying stuff. Seeing what I have in my closet, I do not want to add anything else to it.
While she's not sure if she'll be competing with other renters to grab that must-have fun ugly sweater or wearing something a bit more traditional, odds are she'll be returning it in January. Christian Monroe, NPR News.
It might sometimes feel hard to believe when you're looking at a chihuahua in a cushy dog bed or a golden retriever in a yellow raincoat and boots, but domestic dogs, yes, all domestic dogs, are the descendants of wolves. Now, scientists have long wondered when this switch happened. When did wolves become dogs? And as NPR's Nate Rott reports, a pair of new studies gives us the clearest answer yet.
If you don't have a time machine, there are a couple of ways to look into the past, using ancient DNA and bones. For more than a decade, an international team of scientists have been using both to try to better understand the origin of dogs. Carly Amin, a bioarchaeologist at the University of Exeter, focused on bones, specifically the shape of skulls. And she says in part because of humanity's unique relationship with dogs, there were many skulls to look at.
Usually the animal bone from archaeological sites is very fragmented. It's broken because it's the refuse and the waste or the trash.
Like the discarded remains of a chicken wing.
But dogs, when they die, for whatever reason, they're often deposited in very different ways than you would just throw away your food trash. And it means that their bones preserve a bit better because they're often intentionally buried.
That allowed Amin and her fellow scientists to make detailed 3D models of more than 600 skulls, dating as far back as 50,000 years ago, that they could then search for subtle changes. And one of the biggest surprises they found was that dogs showed a wide range of physical diversity a very long time ago.
By about 10,000 years ago, half of the amount of diversity present in modern dogs is already present in the Neolithic. So very early on in our relationship with dogs, we not only change them from wolves, but they begin to change amongst themselves and generate a lot of diversity.
Not the most extreme changes we see today. Looking at you, French bulldogs, those were the results of selective breeding within the last few hundred years. But even the oldest sample of a known dog from about 11,000 years ago didn't look much like a wolf. Meaning?
It's not a recent dog.
Laurent Franz is a professor of paleogenomics at the University of Munich. And he says the genetic analysis from that same skull shows that it was a hybrid of distinct Western and Eastern dog breeds.
So that means that by 11,000 years, you already had dogs all the way in Siberia and in Europe for thousands of years, probably. And not only you had them in these two separate parts of Eurasia for long enough for them to become different,
but you also had time for them to be brought back together, probably by humans, so they could breed.
So we're looking at a time where everybody had dogs already.
Meaning the wolf-to-dog domestication had to have happened sometime earlier. Both studies published in the journal Science narrow the window, Amin and Franz say, to understanding when this shift happened. And if you're wondering why any of this matters, like why we should care when a wolf became a dog, Amin says consider how important humanity's ability to domesticate wild animals is and has been to our existence. Take cows, sheep, goats, all sorts of plants.
Without them, we have no food. Without them, we have no plants to eat. We have no cereal. Like, the domestication of plants and animals is an enormous impact on human history. It's possibly one of the most important things that humans have ever done. And the dog is the first species we make this relationship with.
So the next time your dog is barking at the delivery person or begging for food, take a breath and appreciate the fact that both you and your furry companion are part of a long storied tradition. Nate Rott, NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this week, Friday and Saturday, November 14th and 15th, in Aiken, Baxter, Gilbert, and Grand Rapids. Starting things off, acclaimed folk musician, theater composer, and disability rights activist Galen Lee is playing at the Underground in Aiken this Friday, a new venue in the basement of the Ripple Center. The singer and violinist has collaborated with artists like Michael Stipe and Alan Sparhawk, won the 2016 NPR Tiny Desk competition, and recently scored the latest run of Macbeth on Broadway. Galen Lee at the Underground this Friday at 6 p.m. in Aiken. In Baxter, Americana and roots rocker Christopher David Hansen is playing Jack Pine Brewery Friday at 6 p.m. A prolific musician, Hansen plays in multiple northern Minnesota bands and mixes blues, rock, and singer-songwriter folk in his solo music. The third Friday show is Jay Streitz at the Ore House in Gilbert, 7 p.m. Streitz is an alt-country songwriter who spent years as a bass player in Twin Cities country bands. He now lives in the Northwoods and leads the group Jay Streitz and the Long Odds, It's this Friday, 7 p.m. at the Orr House in Gilbert. And finally, one Saturday show for you is the duo Between Howls at Rapids Brewing at 6 p.m. Ren and Nick Howell are both Top Knots musicians whose live show ranges from breakneck shredding to soulful ballads and everything in between. They released their debut album Cabin Fever earlier this year. Between Howls this Saturday at Rapids Brewing, 6 p.m. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support for KAXE comes from the Grassroots Concert Series, presenting the Weary Ramblers on Friday, November 21st at 7 p.m. at the Live Well Nightclub and Coffee Bar, located at the Journey Church in Nisswa. Doors open at 6:30. The full fall lineup can be found at grassrootsconcerts.org. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
At macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The end of the nation's longest government shutdown means food assistance for 42 million people will soon be restored. But anxiety from the 12-day funding pause may stick around, as NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Jacqueline Giamona is a single working mom of two boys and buys most of her groceries with SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Last weekend, she was thrilled when California, where she lives, sent out full benefits right after a court ordered the federal government to pay them.
I was really relieved, but I do have something that's like, okay, what if they take it away?
The Trump administration battled that order all the way to the Supreme Court. Giamona can't fathom why the government would deprive low-income people of a necessity like food and considers it an abuse of power.
People are going to distrust the government, and I think people are going to be really angry about it for a long time.
SNAP serves 1 in 8 people in this country, most at or just over the poverty level. It's supposed to be there for anyone who qualifies, and it's never been disrupted before in its 6-decade history, says economist Craig Gunderson at Baylor University.
So in that sense, this is a big surprise. It really has broken this entitlement status of SNAP, and that's of concern.
The administration argued it could not use reserve funds to pay for SNAP during the shutdown, but President Trump repeatedly criticized SNAP as a, quote, Democrat program, and Republicans have long tried to shrink it. At the White House last week, Trump falsely claimed President Biden expanded SNAP randomly.
During Biden, they gave it to anybody that wanted it. I think it's something you have to talk about because the numbers are incredible.
Crystal Fitzsimons with the Food Research and Action Center says targeting SNAP was a policy choice.
It does make me nervous that this could be used as a negotiating tactic again. Once you break a taboo, right, it's that much easier to break a taboo.
The congressional deal to reopen the government funds SNAP through next September. Fitzsimons would like lawmakers to make sure benefits won't ever be held up again.
Could Congress compel USDA to actually act? They could. I'm not sure that we'll be able to get that done before October 1st, 2026.
The Agriculture Department did not respond to NPR's request for comment about these concerns. For all the hardship and anxiety of the past couple weeks, anti-hunger experts like Gunderson say there may be an upside.
If anything, I think that this shutdown and this disruption of SNAP benefits will make Americans more aware this is a really an important program and should retain its entitlement status.
In Phoenix, Brittany Jansen agrees. I caught her at snack time for her two toddlers.
Yes, hang on 1 second. Sorry.
Jansen applied for SNAP 10 months ago after she and her partner racked up thousands in credit card debt for groceries and gasoline. He changed career paths and has yet to find a full-time job. She bartends and they split shifts because they can't afford childcare. She says even her mother was surprised they signed up for food aid.
I mean, when I first told her that we were getting benefits, she was confused because she was like, well, you both have jobs.
Jansen hopes the more people learn about SNAP, the more it will change misperceptions about who gets it and why.
I think maybe everybody hopefully has somebody in their life that is affected by this and it can, you know, kind of make it a little more personal.
That's why she started talking more openly about how SNAP is helping her own family at a tough time. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
College athletes can earn a lot of money through social media by building a brand and putting up sponsored posts, but social media has gotten much more toxic, especially with the rise of sports gambling. Now, many people in college sports are asking themselves, is this worth it? NPR's Becky Sullivan has the story.
In real life, it would be hard to imagine a stranger harassing Cam Corin. He's 21 years old, 6 foot 10, 235 pounds of muscle across his big frame, and he's a Division I college athlete, a basketball player for the Pittsburgh Panthers. None of that, though, stops people on the internet.
Especially with this sports betting and everything now, it's just so different after the games. You'll check your DMs and people are wishing harmful things on family members.
He was a sophomore when he got his first really disturbing messages from an angry gambler.
And I got hurt in the game, and I messed somebody's parlay up, I guess.
Corn had to leave the game early. He scored only 2 points. His team won, but when he got on the bus afterward and turned on his phone, his home screen was filled with threatening messages.
I hope your mom dies. Like, it's some crazy things. And mind you, these are people off burner accounts, so you don't know who they are. You don't know their identity. And you lost their money, so you say really hurtful things.
He was only 19, barely a year removed from leaving home. It rattled him. Finally, this summer, he decided to log off entirely. Practically every athlete today has a story about harassment, gamblers, death threats even. But it's not so easy to just quit social media, because being online is basically a part of the job description for college athletes these days. Here's Kyla Deck, a guard at SMU.
It can maximize the money you're making. It can maximize the stage that you're putting yourself on. Like, you know, as an athlete, you want to be out there. You want people to know your name. You want, put you in rooms that you might not be in.
Yet the harassment of athletes online has become an epidemic. In college, the NCAA says basketball players are most at risk, especially around March Madness, when their data shows thousands of abusive or threatening messages are sent to athletes, many of them from gamblers. Some of the threats are so alarming and specific that the NCAA has to alert law enforcement. More and more players and coaches are deciding that being on social media at all just isn't worth it.
Look, I've had people at the university like, you should tweet more, you should do this. And they're probably right. I have to protect my peace, though.
This is Jeff Capel, Cam Corin's head coach at Pitt. He himself quit X and made his Instagram private a couple years ago after online criticism had started to seep into his home life.
My kids are seeing stuff at home, my children. I'm seeing the stuff, it's affecting me, and I made the decision then that, look, I don't need this, I don't want this, I can't do this anymore.
Social media has become so baked into the business of college sports now, though, that teams have whole staffs dedicated to churning out creative content for players to post. That's true at Florida State, where Brooke Wyckoff is the head coach of the women's team. Sometimes she wonders, what is this all even for?
We spend tons of time and thought and energy and money on photo shoots for recruits and photo shoots for the team. They're not helping us win a basketball game, but they're helping us get the word out about Florida State.
Players can make thousands with sponsored posts, ads essentially, on their feeds. But some have decided that the juice isn't worth the squeeze. North Carolina's Renia Kelly is one of the country's best point guards on one of the country's best teams. She could be an influencer if she wanted, but she doesn't.
I just hate social media because, like, you need to have it so you can reach different people and get your name out there. But it's like, at some point, when can you just enjoy the sport for what it is?
Kelly grew up spending time outdoors, touching grass, so to speak. So she already has a vision of life after basketball, a vision that doesn't involve the internet.
I want to be a farmer. I want a garden. I want crops. I want to have peach trees, apple trees. I want to have everything. I want to be able to go outside and grocery shop on my farm.
She's a junior now with a chance at a career in the WNBA. After that, there will be nothing to stop her from going off the grid. Becky Sullivan, NPR News, Charlotte.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Weather tonight, cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain. Lows 29 to 35 degrees. Southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. This story contains details that may be disturbing for some listeners. A 44-year-old embarrassed man pleaded guilty to multiple counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct Wednesday in St. Louis County. The charges, first announced in August, stem from Ryan Ross Denzer Johnson's repeated assaults against an adolescent relative in 2023 and 2024. Denzer Johnson formerly taught at Mesabi East and at Babbitt and was involved with school robotics programs as well as a leader in his church. The sentence will be determined at a January 5th hearing. In a news release, the St. Louis County Attorney's Office described a plea agreement. The state may pursue a prison sentence of more than 17 years. Denzer Johnson's defense attorneys can argue for the minimum sentence, which state sentencing guidelines place at almost 13 years behind bars. County Attorney Kimberly Mackey says the guilty plea, quote, ensures that Denzer Johnson will be held accountable for the devastating harm he inflicted on a child and commends the bravery of the victim for coming forward. Rural property owners impacted by Bemidji's severe blowdown storm earlier this summer may be able to share the cost of replanting their woods. The Minnesota Forestry Association hosted the first of two webinars earlier this week to discuss state and federal cost-sharing programs available to woodland property owners. Lori Barrow, a DNR forestry specialist out of the Bemidji office, says the DNR's emergency disaster funds can cover up to 50% of costs to prepare damaged wooded areas for reforestation.
Timber removal and mulching work in order to prepare sites for future regeneration, as well as to reduce potential fuel hazards, so wildfire risk in these areas. So here you can see some of the activities that are included, site prep for replanting efforts, replanting woods after a salvage harvest. That includes the cost of those seedlings.
The DNR can't reimburse for woodland work already completed, but can share costs on a forester-approved reforestation plan on storm-damaged woodlands between 3 and 10 acres. The USDA also has a reforestation program through the Farm Service Agency. And while approval has so far been delayed due to the federal shutdown, DNR forester John Carlson says larger wooded parcels impacted by the summer storms could see up to 75% of the cost shared to reforest.
From what I heard the last time it was in the Bemidji area in 2012, that it worked fairly well for people. So we're looking to hopefully make it the case this time as well.
The Minnesota Forestry Association will host its next webinar on state and federal forestry programs on December 8th. And hosts an informational webpage with resources for storm-impacted property owners. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host an open house on its Highway 34 corridor study in Park Rapids next week. The meeting will be 4 to 8 p.m. Tuesday at Park Rapids City Hall. The corridor study focuses on Highway 34 between Western Avenue South and east of Hubbard County Road 4, also known as the Emmaville Road. The study is separate from the nearby Highway 71 corridor study. A resurfacing project on Highway 34 is anticipated in the next 7 to 10 years, with other potential improvements like increased pedestrian facilities possible. Project staff members will be at the open house to share information, answer questions, and gather public input. A state task force is looking for input from people who gather mushrooms, berries, or other plants on state lands. The Minnesota Sustainable Foraging Task Force was created by the legislature earlier this year. The group is tasked with developing foraging guidelines for state lands that balance public access with conservation needs. The task force is hosting 3 online public input sessions, one on Wednesday, one on November 20th, and one on December 3rd. They want to know what you forage, how you do it, concerns about effects on other recreational experiences, and areas of confusion around the current rules. Visit our website for more information. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. U.S. Catholic bishops took on two hot-button issues this week at their meeting in Baltimore: immigration enforcement and gender-affirming care for transgender people. Here to talk about what went on is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Let's start with immigration. What did the bishops say?
Well, they approved a statement that reads in part, quote, "We are disturbed when we see among our people a climate of fear and anxiety around questions of profiling and immigration enforcement." But it goes on to say, quote, "We recognize that nations have a responsibility to regulate borders and establish a just and orderly immigration system for the sake of the common good." Now, at one point, Cardinal Blaise Supich of Chicago argued for even stronger language.
Should we not say that we oppose the indiscriminate deportation of people, which is taking place today? I think that's the central issue.
And Scott, that language was added. You know, 3 in 10 Catholics in the U.S. are immigrants, according to Pew Research. So this is a crucial issue for the church here. And our reporting has shown that attendance is down at some predominantly Latino congregations around the U.S. because of fears of immigration actions.
Now, there had been a lot of hope from some quarters that the bishops would go further. They would say more, right?
All right. Statements like this are fairly rare. So when they happen, people know it's serious. For instance, the last time they made one of these was a dozen years ago to criticize some provisions of the Affordable Care Act. So, having said that, at least one bishop at the meeting said this statement on immigration didn't go far enough. And perhaps more importantly, Pope Leo had asked bishops to speak out clearly and strongly. Last week, Leo himself spoke to reporters outside Rome and said he was deeply concerned about the treatment of immigrants in the U.S., especially that some were being denied the Eucharist.
Let's talk about another topic. What actions did the Catholic bishops take regarding treatment for transgender people at Catholic hospitals?
Well, they're officially barring those hospitals run by the church from providing gender-affirming care for trans people, such as hormone treatment or surgeries. Here's Bishop Robert Barron from Minnesota speaking during the meeting, describing a conversation he had with the late Pope Francis on the topic.
As we were ending a 3-hour discussion with him, he specifically said to us, "I want you to fight gender ideology, which is repugnant to the Bible and to our tradition."
Now, these new rules also say Catholic hospitals can't refer trans people elsewhere for care. And that's similar to how these hospitals also deal with contraception and abortion care, for example. Now, this directive from the Catholic bishops comes as other religious leaders are publicly expressing their support for trans people. Just yesterday, the leaders of a number of denominations, including Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Reformed Jews, put out a statement that said, quote, "Our faiths call on us to proclaim that transgender, intersex, and non-binary people deserve respect, love, and equal rights."
How do these actions and statements by the bishops square with the beliefs of everyday Catholics?
Well, you know, there's a clear disconnect between what the church and the bishops teach and what Catholics actually believe and do. Polling shows, for instance, that majorities of Catholics favor contraception from some form of birth control, abortion rights, and LGBTQ rights. But it's not just a disconnect with people in the pews. It's also a disconnect with the Pope. Pope Leo asked bishops bishops to speak out strongly on immigration. Instead, they took a more pastoral approach, I might say, expressing their concern for their flock rather than what might be called a prophetic approach, calling for change. Now, at the same time, they elected a new conference president this week and went with a clear conservative, Archbishop Paul Coakley from Oklahoma City. He beat out another bishop from a diocese on the U.S. southern border, Bishop Daniel Flores of Brownsville, Texas. However, Flores was elected vice president of the conference, which some Catholics who care about a lot about immigration see as a sign of hope.
That is NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose. Jason, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
A movie celebrity realizes late in life that he got so wrapped up in his career, he neglected his daughters. Critic Bob Mondello says that's the story in not one, but two new movies, the European drama Sentimental Value and the Hollywood comedy J. Kelly.
J. Kelly is a movie star.
An action.
Handsome, affable, debonair, 60-something. Think George Clooney. Same consonant sounds even. J. Kelly, George Clooney, good fit.
What do you say to people who say you only play yourself?
I mean, he's not actually playing himself.
You know how difficult it is to be yourself?
But it helps Noah Baumbach's midlife crisis dramedy if you sort of go along with the notion Kelly is a bit of an empty vessel.
I'm just an actor that got famous.
Who's reached a point where he's doubting his life choices. His marriage long gone, his older daughter completely estranged, his younger one.
I'm leaving on Saturday for Paris.
This is your last summer. It'll be so lonely here without you.
No, it won't. You're never alone.
Really? I'm always alone.
And aide hands him his coffee.
Thanks a lot.
That's a joke, but sure, a guy who pays his best pals, manager Adam Sandler and publicist Laura Dern, might well feel something's missing. Could he find it in an impromptu trip to Europe? His horrified handlers forced to book train tickets so he can seem to bump into his daughter? It at least lets him play to the crowd.
Nice, by the way. These are the best peanuts I've ever had. Try one.
It's a good peanut, a European peanut.
I didn't offer you one because I know about your allergy.
That's right. My throat will close and I will die.
How can I play people when I don't see people? Touch people.
Don't touch people.
Quips and Clooney's magnetism go a decent way to making all this loneliness of stardom kvetching palatable, and Sandler's a sharp antidote when he's on screen. But J. Kelly's not nearly as affecting about the alleged heartbreak of success as, say, Lost in Translation or Fellini's 8½.
Everything you thought you were isn't true.
And cut.
Can we go again?
Really?
I'd like another one.
Not sure that would help. What's wrong with J. Kelly is quickly put right in Joaquin Trier's Sentimental Value.
You working on anything new?
Something like that.
In this one, Stellan Skarsgård plays Gustav, a film director. His neglected daughters, Nora and Agnes, are a few years older, and their estrangement's not played for laughs because it's not funny. When Nora says, "You don't know us," her father's response is a bemused, "Everyone's mad at Dad, eh?" In fairness, there's a reason. Gustav has shown up at the funeral for their mom, not to mourn the ex-wife he left long ago, but with a screenplay he's written for Nora, who's an accomplished stage actress, no thanks to him. He's set the screenplay in the house they grew up in and made it about their own family's trauma going back generations. Nora angrily turns him down, at which point he casts a visiting American star, played by Elle Fanning, who of course gets in touch with Nora.
Why didn't you want to do the role?
I can't work with him. We can't really talk. My father is very difficult person.
The filmmaker's focus, you'll notice, is on the daughter, not on Dad. So even though Skarsgård's director is thinking only of himself, Sentimental Value doesn't feel like insider navel-gazing. Trier anchors the film in an ornate Victorian home where the dynamics are fraught, the performances, especially Renata Reinsve's Nora, as understated as they are heartbreaking, and the plot, which keeps you guessing up to the final moments of the final scene, is riveting. Unlike J. Kelly, no need for a retake. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Over the past 2 months, a prosecutor handpicked by President Trump has secured indictments against two of Trump's perceived enemies, former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James. Today, attorneys for Comey and James argued in federal court that the prosecutor was improperly appointed and their cases should be dismissed. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas was in the courtroom and joins us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Okay, so just remind us what these cases against Jim Comey and Tish James are about.
So first, just to be clear, Comey and James were charged separately. So these are two separate cases.
Right.
Comey was charged in September with false statements and obstruction of a congressional proceeding. The case against him stems from testimony that he gave Congress back in 2020. He has pleaded not guilty. Letitia James, meanwhile, she was charged in early October with bank fraud and false statements to a financial institution. Those charges are tied to a house that she bought in Virginia in 2020. She has also pleaded not guilty. But these cases against the both of them were presented to a grand jury by Lindsay Halligan. Halligan is a former White House aide and insurance lawyer who Trump handpicked to be the interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia after career prosecutors there had concluded that the evidence was too weak in both instances to move forward with the case. Now, both Comey and James are challenging the legality of Halligan's appointment, and so that's why their attorneys were in one courtroom together today making their case before a federal judge.
Okay, and what did they say?
Well, there's a lot of overlap in what their attorneys had to say, but the heart of this particular legal dispute centers on laws that govern the temporary appointment of a U.S. attorney. I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but the statute allows the attorney general to appoint an interim U.S. attorney for 120 days. Once those 120 days run out, if there's no Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney, then the local federal court can appoint its own candidate until the Senate confirms someone. Now, both Comey and James argue that that 120-day limit is a one-time thing. In other words, the attorney general can't keep making interim appointments, each with a 120-day time limit, because that would gut the Senate's role in confirming U.S. attorneys. Now, the Justice Department, for its part, it argues that that interpretation is wrong. It says the attorney general can make multiple 120-day interim appointments, and it says the clock restarts with each one.
Okay, and now explain how does that factor specifically into the cases against Comey and against James?
Well, the key fact here is that someone already served for 120 days as interim U.S. attorney during this Trump administration. Trump pushed that person out in September after he had expressed reservations about pursuing these two specific cases. But because he had served on an interim basis for the full 120 days, Comey and James say that legally that means that Halligan cannot. And that means that Halligan was unlawfully appointed. And because of that, they say the indictments that she secured against Comey and James are invalid and should be dismissed. Now, DOJ, for its part, it says that this dispute is at best, it called it a paperwork error. And it says Halligan has the full authority to pursue these prosecutions.
Huh. Okay. Well, Ryan, you were in the courtroom today. Did you get a sense of how the judge is going to rule?
Well, the judge presiding today was Judge Cameron McGowan Curry. She's usually based in South Carolina, but she was assigned to hear the legal challenges to Halligan's appointment. Now, Curry sounded skeptical of some of the Justice Department's positions. I wouldn't read into that too much. Today's hearing lasted only a little over an hour, and Judge Curry said at the end that she planned to rule on the matter before Thanksgiving. So we should have an answer in the next couple of weeks.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic Gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. The Bemidji Senior Center is looking for donations of holiday decorations ahead of their sale on December 5th. Donations may be dropped off at the Senior Center on 3rd Street in downtown Bemidji, weekdays from 9 to 4. Tickets are now on sale for Home is Where the Heart Is, a benefit for Grace House, Itasca County's only homeless shelter. The event is Thursday, December 4th, but tickets must be purchased before November 26th at Grand Rapids Super One stores, Timberlake Lodge, or Grace House. Great Lakes Area Performing Arts will hold auditions for the Tin Woodman of Oz, November 17th and 18th from 6 to 9, both nights at Pequot Lakes High School Auditorium. There are roles for adults and youth ages 10 and up. Now I'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 40 years ago today, a volcanic eruption in Colombia caused an avalanche that killed 25,000 people in the town of Armero. It was one of the deadliest natural disasters ever in Latin America, and Armero was never rebuilt. As John Otis reports, many survivors are still in mourning.
Driving through the ruins of Armero, veterinarian Fernando Angarita shows me where the bakery, the hospital, and the Presbyterian church once stood. Later, Angarita points to a boulder the size of a cargo truck. It arrived with the avalanche on the evening of November 13th, 1985. The deluge was caused by the eruption of snow-capped Nevado del Ruiz volcano 30 miles west of here. Warnings to evacuate arrived too late. The flood of lava, mud, and debris buried this once bustling farm town.
Me sacó la avalancha de aquí del pueblo y me descargó 6 kilómetros abajo en esa licuadora.
Angarita was caught by the massive mudslide that carried him nearly 4 miles out of town. He suffered 16 fractures to his face and jaw and compares it to being inside a blender. Angarita, who's now 71, says, I have no idea why I'm still alive. These days, tour guides lead people through a wasteland of half-buried buildings and makeshift gravestones. Esther Forijsvik, who's from the Netherlands, found Armero more moving than the petrified ruins of Pompeii.
If we're going to visit a place like this in Europe, totally structured and like renovated, you don't feel real that it happened for real. But here it's like everything is how it was, so it's quite powerful.
So it's nice to see you later in the...
The biggest attraction is a shrine to Omaida Sanchez. Only 13, she was found by rescue workers in water up to her neck and trapped by debris. As they tried to save her, she spoke to TV journalists.
Mama, si me escuchas, reza para que yo pueda caminar y esta gente me ayude.
Mommy, she says, if you can hear me, pray so that I can walk again and that these people can help me. After spending 70 hours in the water, Sanchez died of hypothermia.
Many Colombians consider Omaida Sanchez an unofficial saint, and here at her gravesite, they've placed hundreds of stone plaques thanking her for the blessings they believe that she's bestowed upon them.
4 decades later, there are still many unanswered questions about the tragedy. For example, Nevado del Ruiz was a highly active volcano, and it's unclear why there were so few warnings ahead of the catastrophic eruption.
Y el día de hoy ya hay 583 casos reportados.
583 children are reported by relatives as unaccounted for, says Francisco González, an Armero native who is leading an investigation into what happened to them. Many likely perished in the landslide. Others were adopted. However, chaos reigned after the disaster, record keeping was shoddy, and the fate of these children may never be known. To mark the 40th anniversary of the tragedy, survivors launch hundreds of model boats into a nearby river in a symbolic search for truth. Their tiny sails are emblazoned with photos of the missing children.
About half of the little boats immediately overturn in the rapids, but the rest of them seem to be staying upright, surviving.
Sí, muy fuerte, pero estamos aquí.
Among the missing is the younger brother of Mariela Diaz. Every year, she makes a pilgrimage back to her hometown of Armero to look for him.
Pero a mi hermano sí, lo vieron muchas personas. Entonces, la esperanza de pronto de que él regrese aquí está viva.
My brother did survive. Lots of people saw him, Diaz says. So we still have hope that maybe he will reappear. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Armero, Colombia.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain Podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from a listener named Stasha. She asked us that we only use her middle name because she's sharing sensitive information about her mental health. When she was 21 and struggling with deep depression, Stasha attempted suicide. She ended up at a small hospital and after a few hours decided to leave. Without telling anyone, Stasha slipped away undetected. She walked until she reached a nearby road where she stuck out her thumb for a ride.
I was very obviously lost. Not lost in the sense of I didn't know where I was, but lost in the sense that I had no direction or purpose. And I had just gone through a traumatic experience, and I had no shoes on, and all I wanted to do was get back to my house. That's when my unsung hero appeared. A person in a convertible stopped by the side of the road and picked me up. The only question she asked me was, "Where do you want to go?" No judgment, no expectations, just acceptance. My first thought was relief and a feeling of being safe. I got in the car, we drove, talked about art, music, nature. She dropped me off at my house about 40 minutes later, and I never saw her again. I'm 68 years old now. All of my career was spent in human services, working with high-risk teens, people with disabilities, and families, and I could really pinpoint it back to that act of acceptance from that person in my time of need. It's sort of meeting people where they are and letting them be who they are without being judgmental. I'm not going to say that throughout 40 years I never made a judgment or jumped to a conclusion, but I made it a tenet in my life that that's not how I wanted to be treated, and I don't want to treat other people like that. And that's the way I want to feel that I can contribute in this world.
That was Stasha. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks at progressivecommercial.com. From The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows 29 to 34 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs 54 to 60. South winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Evening lows in the mid-30s to low 40s.